Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have a really kind of interesting comment to read to start out today. And again, I just appreciate when people do comment. It says, hello again, JBL. What a wonderful and thought-provoking program on utopian and dystopian societies. Whereas the world views utopia as fanciful and dystopia as the norm, my thoughts are rather revolutionary. I believe that utopia is the norm and we are just in a glitch in the cosmic ocean of time of dystopia and that it will be rectified. No utopia can be maintained if there are areas of dystopia. Therefore, utopia must be ever-expanding or built and is an empire-building utopian society. Thomas More only had an island for his utopia. He thought too small. What a vision this can give to the people stuck in the present dystopia. So I thought that was interesting. So someone's out there thinking, which is really good. So last program, we did finish our 60-plus panel discussion of More's Utopia Book 2. And I hope you enjoyed listening to the programs as much as we enjoyed preparing for them. Now, I need to make a small correction to what I said in the first program with the 60-plus panel. I said that William Shakespeare talked about England as the sceptered isle in the play Henry V. Now, actually, it was the play Richard II, so sorry about that, but sometimes when you read a lot of Shakespeare, you can get your plays confused. Well, today, what I'd like to do is I want to give you my final thoughts on More's Utopia. And maybe it's actually a little better if I said that I would just like to talk some more about the subject of Utopia because of More's book. So I think there's a lot more that we can say about the subject of Utopia. And so here's the point. If you haven't read the book yet, or if you haven't finished the book yet, there's still time for you to do so. And I really highly recommend it. It is a great little book. But I also think it's a book that you're going to have to probably, well, reread maybe even three times in order to really, you know, kind of suck out the fruit that's in there. Or maybe I should say suck out the juice of the fruit. I'm just trying to be a little poetic today, so I'm by myself here. But anyway, it is really worth reading, and I think the more times you read it, the more rich your understanding will be of the book. But the thing is I really want to just say this in maybe concluding or summarizing the book itself. It really is an unusual little book. And I think it just kind of reveals a lot about More's character. Now, we know that that he was high in the government structure under Henry VIII. We know that he was a gifted scholar and teacher. But he really must have been a man of personality. And, of course, we know he read a lot of the philosophers and, you know, he read a lot about, you know, the Greeks and the Roman, the classics. And but at times, More is really being very serious in the book. And, of course, that whole beginning, the book one, is all this didactic, you know, Socratic method of, you know, teaching through conversation. And so some of that is very serious. But at other times, he's really playing with us. I mean, he's really being, you know, funny and satirical. And, of course, I've used this many times in the programs. And a good example of when he plays with us is his use of names. And if you look at Professor Pamela Bedore, excuse me, for I even mispronounced that before, but it's Bedore. She even says that that's actually part of the genre of Utopia, is to kind of use made up names and all that. And there's hidden meanings in those names. And of course, we've said that Raphael Hitherde's name means talker of nonsense. Now, we also know that that is Moore that really is the one that dreamed up the word utopia. And, of course, he put it together from the Greek. And there's two Greek words there, and you means no, and topia means place. And so, essentially, when he's talking about the island, it doesn't exist. It's no place. But then we know that he's also using its homonym, utopia, and that's spelled E-U-topia, which means happy place. And so if you're not looking at a text and you hear the word utopia, it could be spelled E-U-T-O-P-I-A, or it could be spelled U-T-O-P-I-A. So you would be confused unless you could actually read which one is there. And so he is really playing with us. Now, at times, he's very practical. And I think the best examples of that is when we get into book two. And essentially what he does, if you really take the time and, you know, separate the book out and try and divide it into sections for yourself, or even if you would say, let's say, go back to high school and try and outline it for yourself, you can see that what he's saying there, what Moore is really trying to get across to us through this character Hitherde, is that if you're going to build a utopian society, you have to have some basic structures. There's basic elements of society that you must have. For example, you know, he spends a lot of time talking about the economy. And we know that people in utopia, they have to work on a farm for 2 years to produce goods, but they also have to have their own craft or skill so that there can be an economy, so there can be business, so that people can, you know, provide means to, well, you know, take care of their expenses. But then they also provide for the needs of others. So there's the economy. He also, you know, talks about education. And in any utopia, you can't have a utopia unless people are educated. And the point is he brings out about utopia, that, you know, this little island of utopia is that people are, first of all, they're educated in farming. In other words, they go to school, they have practical classes, they have to get out in the fields and work. But then they're also trained in a skill. And, you know, that's really been typical of a lot of societies. Even, you know, at the time of Christ, we know the Apostle Paul, not only was he a great student and a scholar, but he also was a tent maker. And the times when there was no funds from the church to support him, he supported himself by making tents. So, and that was very much in the Jewish society at that time. Even Jesus Christ, if you know the truth of it, he was a carpenter, and of course he was a preacher. And so even Christ learned how to support himself. And so that's really important. Okay, one of the other basic things he brings out is even in the government of utopia, or the society of utopia, there's government, there's law and punishment. Now, Moore doesn't spend a lot of time with those things, but he does give a basic structure of the government. And I think it's very interesting that the senior elder in the family, you know, had authority over that family. And remember, I don't remember exact number, but remember in the housing groups, there were so many adults with an elder. But then there also they had, you know, local officials, and then they had the Senate or the national officials. And so there's also, remember, he does talk about punishment. But he doesn't really talk enough about law, I think. I think he kind of left all of that out, or left that open for you to think about. You know, he does talk about international relations. You know, that's a utopian society has to know how to interconnect with all other societies. And so, you know, he talks about even, you know, utopian travel. He talks about, you know, if some cities get so big, they have to form colonies. They go back to the mainland and they form a colony, and that colony interrelates with the people of that land. And so international relations are part of it. He also talks about social order and, you know, the civilization and the culture. And so, as we discussed in that panel, we said that, well, they all dressed the same, so it must have been pretty boring. And every city looked the same, and every household was basically the same. So every time they had to transfer or move from house to house, it was like they didn't have to worry about not being at home because it looked like their home. And so there was a social order, and there was a culture there. And so that's all very important to, well, a society or to a utopia. And then he also talks about religion. And I do think it's interesting the way he talks about religion. He talks about the religion of the utopians was based on the god Mithra, or that's Mithraism. And it really is interesting that if you look at, well, let's say the church today that feels it's like the number one Christian church, you know, a lot of what their teachings are based on that idea of Mithraism. And it has a lot to do with, well, the god of light. And it's not by chance that they go to church on Sunday, or the worship of the Sunday, basically, is what it is. So even if you look at some of the holidays that are coming up here at the end of December, they really are based on Mithraism. And so again, the December holidays are really worship of the sun, because it's so dark right now. And then once the winter solstice happens, then there becomes more light, or the sun becomes, you know, back alive, kind of thing. So it is really, really interesting that way. Now, if you remember reading the book, if you haven't read it, you know, I still recommend you read it. But remember, some of what he suggests seems rational. Other things don't. The book is kind of full of irony. You know, there's things that are funny. There's things that aren't funny. But there are things that say in that society that even I was surprised that Moore would even write. And that's where the irony comes in. For example, when he says in the book that a young couple should see each other naked before marriage so to prevent petty annoyances, I would never have expected that to come from a deeply religious man. And we know that Thomas Moore was a deeply religious man, and even the Catholic Church has canonized him a saint. So I think that's where he was just throwing some things out there to, just get people thinking. Also, if you look at the religion, we didn't talk about this so much, but if you look at it in detail, essentially, they even allowed women priests in Utopia, and the Catholic Church has never allowed that. And so remember, Moore was a devout Catholic. So there's a lot of irony in the book. Now, I think my final thoughts are probably going to, you know, take up two programs here. So I think you're going to find it very interesting, and at least I believe you should find it interesting. So let's move on a little bit again, not so much about the book, but about the subject of the book. Now, if you look at, let's say the book was written in 1516, so here we are 5 centuries later. I think what's interesting is scholars have been studying this book for over 5 centuries now. And they really pull it apart because they really are curious about, well, what would a utopian society actually look like? Now, Pam Bedore, in her class that I've been taking on DVD, I think she has some really good quotes about that. And I want to ask you a question after we go through these quotes. So in her lecture, she does say, she's talking about the book Utopia, but she's also talking about the subject. She says, Utopia doesn't have a plot exactly, but the philosophy's framed as a conversation, and we as a reader have a point of identification. This means also that we're presented with a clear argument about how to get to a better society. Imitate the beautiful island of Utopia. There's enough irony throughout the text that the reader is left to wrestle with figuring out what does and doesn't make sense in this society. And she goes on to say, and yeah, 500 years later, 500 years since the publication of this text, scholars are still debating exactly how all of those ironies work. And so there are scholars, there's scholars in government, there's scholars, you know, even just in literature, they're trying to figure out what is Moore really trying to say there. And the thing is, I think there are a lot of other scholars that have looked at Moore's book, and they really have worked hard to, well, build a perfect society. And, you know, here's another quote that she says, that she has in her lecture, which I thought was really interesting. She says, "Now the scholarship on utopia is exciting. It's expansive, and it's no surprise that some of our greatest philosophers like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels have written extensively on the topic." And so if you look at even our world today, and we look at government in our world today, I think we can see where the concepts that Moore brings out in his book have been tried, and they've been put into, they've been put into practice, into play. Now, here's the big question I want you to think about. Do you really believe that we could have a utopia? Do you think a utopia is even possible? And then also ask the question, if all these scholars have been studying this for so long, here's five centuries, that's over 500 years, why don't we see a utopia on Earth today? I mean, it's we don't really see one. Now, people think we have utopian societies. People think we have it pretty nice. Of course, you know, in the Western world, especially, I think in the United States and the other English-speaking countries of the world, I think we have experienced and lived by unparalleled wealth in the world. But if you look at the third world countries, if you look at other countries, let's say in Asia, it has not been that way. And so why isn't the whole world, you know, a utopia? Well, the thing is, I do believe that the utopias are possible. And in fact, here's why I believe that. About five decades ago, our college namesake, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, he did write a small book on the subject of a sure-to-come globe-girdling utopia. Now, essentially, he based his understanding on the Bible. There are Bible prophecies that show that this world is going to one day burst into a utopia. It's going to be a perfect society. And what he did is he wrote a little booklet called The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. And while Thomas More leaves all this doubt about what the basic elements of a utopian society should be, Mr. Armstrong actually uses Bible prophecy, and he provides a concrete scenario of what the God-established utopia will be like. And so I'd like to offer you that little booklet. I mean, you can write to thetrumpet.com, and you can either download The Wonderful World Tomorrow, or you can request a copy, and there's never going to be any follow-up. It's all free to you. But like I said, some people think that we are living in a world with utopian-like conditions. But Mr. Armstrong, in his book, he actually shows us that if we take a really good look behind world conditions, if we look behind all the glitter and the glitch, we're going to see that we're really pretty far from a utopian society. So I just wanted to quote a few things from the book. And let's use some of those elements that Moore brings out in his book. Let's talk about modern education. And I'm going to read to you what Mr. Herbert Armstrong wrote about modern education. This is from this book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. And again, I've had the opportunity to read this many, many times over the years. And I first came across this book, I'd say around the late 90s. He goes on to say, in this book, this is page 10 of the book, if you go ahead and write for it, so you'll be able to, you know, follow along. If you have a pencil and paper, you could write some of these things down. But he says, modern education trains students to earn a living in the professions, occupations, and vocations, but fails to teach them how to live. And so Mr. Armstrong really believes education has become very materialistic. It commits the crime of developing the machine, but it fails to develop the man. In modern education, we find perpetuation of false values, the teaching of distorted history, warped psychology, perverted arts and sciences, worthless knowledge. And we know, I mean, it's a lot of historians, let's say maybe your conservative historians, are very upset about the revisionist history being written today. I mean, people are rewriting history about even the founding fathers of America. That's just not true. And they're trying to, well, promote their own agendas. It says, in modern education, we find a perpetuation of false values, the teaching of distorted history, warped psychology, perverted arts and sciences, and worthless knowledge. And even Mr. Stephen Fleury, and when I'm recording this today, he gave a wonderful Trouble Daily program about, you know, a very famous psychologist that actually really lied and really deceived people. And that was Sigmund Freud. He was a phony. And so you know, he has a warped psychology. He says, recently, a leading expert on educational philosophy, Dr. Donald M. Dozer, and he was a professor emeritus at the history at the University of California, at Santa Barbara. He says, in an article titled Educational Humbuggery, he wrote this about contemporary university education. He said, ours is an age dominated by half-truths, and for this situation, many causes can be found, not at least of which are attributable to the process of higher education. American universities, he added, have succumbed to the call of faddism, sensationalism, even of vulgarism. New courses in scatology, whether masquerading as sociology, anthropology, or literature, have been given classroom platforms and respectability. As students have become increasingly involved in curricular planning, they have encouraged the idea that courses rich in content inhibit their creative impulses and represent an imposition upon them. This has led to the multiplication of colleges of creative studies, which might be better called colleges of undisciplined studies, where the lectures are eschewed as bourgeois and students educate themselves in rap sessions. Now, that was from the book, The University Bookman, Winter, 1978. So you can see that's an older quote, but it really is true today. Okay, let's look at what Mr. Armstrong says about our modern government. And this is going to be page 14 of this book. And, you know, here, all these scholars, all these politicians, many, many, many of them have discussed Moore's book, have studied it, and is our government really any better? Notice this. Mr. Armstrong says, the modern world has produced three more or less new forms of government. Each promises peace, happiness, and prosperity for its people. They are 1, the French and United States republics, 2, the Swedish and British type limited monarchy, and 3, atheistic communism. Now, Karl Marx loved Moore's book, and communism really is very much like, well, the island of Utopia, where everything is, you know, shared collectively. But it hasn't produced, you know, happiness, that's for sure. It says all three are based on a system of industry and on diffusion of education, and all three are predicated on the theory that every individual has the right to share in the benefits of science, industry, and the modern life. But actually, too often what we find is selfish, greedy men of excessive vanity, ambitious in their lust for rule, scheming to get their hands on the throttle of power for personal aggrandizement and monetary gain. We find secret deals, graft, immorality, deception, dishonesty, running rampant in high places. Governments promise peace but bring wars. Now, that's you can see that on your nightly news today. Okay, let's look at the other thing of religion as well. And this is probably all I'm going to be able to get to today. But here's what Mr. Armstrong wrote about religion. You just see if we have a utopian religious society today. He says, well, surely we should expect to find at long last in religion the knowledge of life's purpose, the true values, and the right ways that should make this world a better world, a happy world, a peaceful world. Here at last, we must surely find a stabilizing and uplifting influence for society. Yet shocking though it be, Incredible though it is, if we put the searchlight on the facts and view them realistically with an open mind, we find here the most sickening disillusionment of all. Reluctant though we are to recognize it, we find the established religious organizations which profess the name of Jesus Christ teaching the diametric opposite of his teachings. The churches of the Western world are divided and in confusion. They have not converted, saved, and reformed the whole world as they profess to have been accomplished to do. If that be their mission, they have failed miserably. Look at all the other religions of the world: Buddhism, Shintoism, Taoism, Confucianism, Muslimism, Hinduism, and others. In most countries where these religions are embraced, we find illiteracy, poverty, degeneration, misery, suffering, despair, general unhappiness. None of them has produced a happy world. They have spawned communal wars, hatreds, and violence. And so, now where does this leave us? And Mr. Armstrong does sum it up for us. This is page 18. He said, when we take a hard, cold, realistic view of conditions and trends, they do point inevitably to a fast-approaching world crisis, combined nuclear war, starvation, uncontrollable disease epidemics, crime and violence, and the extinction of human life on this planet. Man has no solutions. But he goes on to say, and yet absolute utopia is soon to grip this earth in our time. We shall see world peace. Well, that's about all the time I have for today. So again, you can download or request a free copy of The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, at thetrumpet.com. And remember, there's never any follow-up. Next time, I'll continue my final thoughts on Thomas More's much-studied work, Utopia. We'll look at the marvelous details of the coming utopia. Remember, the next book up for our utopian dystopian literature series is George Orwell's classic 1984. We'll be using the Signet Classic Edition. It's available at Amazon for about $8. If you're not a Prime member, it'll be about $10. Also, you can find the book for about $6 at abebooks.com. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.